Jennifer was lying out on a gurney, and we examined her from head to toe. The bruising was all over the face. The marks on the neck were darker and deeper. It looked like she was strangled.
From the first headlines about the case, when the media described Robert Chambers as the preppy killer, there was nothing preppy about him. The first couple of weeks were all centered on Robert Chambers and what a great background he came from and what a fine young man he must be. And that battle remained in front of us the entire way.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds in our last season. And with me today is...
I'm not sure I want to go right behind a scream, but I'm going to because I'm going to be screaming and angry in this episode. But Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti, the casting director for the one and only... Criminal Minds forever, and shall it be. So there we go. I don't care.
All right, final season starts when? I've been tweeting about
January.
So January. We'll put the dates on our website, and it's coming soon. January 2020, Criminal Minds, season 15.
That's right.
A wrap up. All right.
Goodness gracious. It seems like the end of an era. A real shame, but it sounds like the final season is going to be very exciting from what Harry Bring and
others
are tweeting.
Very sad. It's going to be a real tearjerker, but anyway.
There's a lot of stuff going on. There'll be highs and there'll be lows and there'll be craziness. So it's really cool. But it was great that we got 10 episodes as writers to wrap up this 15 years of Criminal Minds. And we're really excited about this final season. But today, we're here to talk about what we would like to call the death of Jennifer Levin.
That's right.
And we're doing that in the context of a new series. It's a 5-hour Sundance Channel and AMC TV miniseries. They titled The Preppy Murder. It's about the murder of Jennifer Levin, an 18-year-old girl on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, whose life was taken and her body was left on the grass right behind the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say those who are following me will know that I'm a very angry woman right now. And I'm angry because we've been talking about Jennifer's case. Lisa and I jumped on to talk about it with Bobby Friedman. And it was 1986 this case happened. And people were saying, oh, well, this case probably wouldn't happen now in the Me Too movement. But actually, there's a case currently going on in New Zealand, the murder of a young backpacker called Grace Mullane. And it's exactly the same defense being used, a rough sex gone wrong defense. And also, one of the cases that I did get involved with was back at court today, the murder of Natalie Connolly. And this was a rough sex defense case again that I wrote to the Attorney General about last year in December. Because although she had 40 injuries and she had a fractured eye socket and she had a bottle of bleach inserted in her vagina and she bled out at the bottom of the stairs whilst her partner went to bed and went to sleep. And the next morning he called 999 and he said that she was as dead as a donut. I quote, as dead as a donut, showed no remorse. And he ended up pleading guilty to manslaughter. And his sentence was 3 years and 8 months. 3 years and 8 months. And
oh my God.
Exactly, Jim. And everyone, myself included, was angered by this. There was widespread outrage. And I wrote to the Attorney General and I spoke about the case on social media and I did a digital clip saying, please, can everybody else write to the Attorney General? Well, we expected that the case would be reviewed for an unduly lenient sentence, but that didn't happen. And in fact, today he had the audacity to take the case back to court to appeal what he was saying, his sentence that was too long and was asking for it to be reduced on the grounds that he was drunk and therefore it was an error in judgment, not helping her, not seeking help. where in fact to spend that money to actually get it to a court of appeal where three judges made a decision, the right decision, I have to say, that it should not be reduced as a sentence and it was not unduly lenient. We all felt that his sentence actually should have been increased, not that there should have even been a reduction hearing. And I was talking with her brother earlier today, and the family are completely incensed, as you can imagine, of why her life, why she was put on trial, and it became about her kinky sex habits and what she enjoyed. And he is a multimillionaire too. And so there are real echoes of similarities with Jennifer Levin's case, but also the fact that men are actually getting away with murder. And since Natalie's case, when I wrote to the Attorney General in December last year, I said that this unduly lenient sentence will open the door to more and similar defences of consensual sex and rough sex gone wrong. And since I wrote, there's been 12 other cases.
Wow.
So New Zealand is no surprise. Grace Mullane, who went out and had a Tinder date with this one guy, and a week later, her body turns up. She had been put into a suitcase, and he claimed that he parted company with her. He didn't know anything about it. But in court, a pathologist said that, and it was proven that he had been with her. There was CCTV footage of them walking together. But a pathologist also said that he had never seen a case like this before, and that he believed that her injuries were sustained and she was restrained for some time, and it was a deliberate and intentional act. So I know we're going to get into it with Jennifer's case, but I feel really angry about the fact that it feels like we're going backwards at times and not moving forwards, particularly when at the moment in the UK there are 59 cases like this. And someone called Harriet Harman, an MP, is who I worked with to create Domestic Homicide Review. She is trying to close this loophole of this defence. And it's kind of similar to what we used to have, and it used to be called at the bar, the nagging, shagging defence. Well, she did this or she did that, therefore I was provoked into killing her, the loss of control. This is like the replacement for that. And Jennifer's case happening here and airing at similar times, you know, and I've been reading a lot of the traffic where the producers and directors are being asked, well, would this case happen today? You know, this was 1986, and some are saying, well, I'm not really sure. What I can say, it's happening. It's happening
right now.
Absolutely.
Well, and that's 33 years ago that this happened. And you would think that by now the laws had been changed. We'll get into it later, but there has been a lot of change in laws in the U.S. These rape victim shield laws were actually promoted by Jennifer's mother, Ellen Levin. And she actually became quite an advocate, just like you, Laura, and has worked very hard over these last 33 years to help protect not only the victims, but their reputations. And that is an important part of it. It's not something that you should be able to just destroy just because the victim is dead. That doesn't mean you can't, you can say whatever you want about them and use whatever lies you want. And we'll definitely get into this, especially when we're talking about Jack Lightman.
We will. And I think it's amazing what Ellen's done, but I guess my anger is always, it's cumulative, because as we've been working through Epstein and the hundreds of victims, and as we've been talking about Harvey Weinstein, and again, hundreds of victims. And
all this entitlement, it just starts to bear down on you, what they can get away with.
It does. And victims being blamed and shamed and the judgment, and then having a female advocate like Lisa Bloom, it all starts to stack up and you start to feel, where is it right that a victim should be blamed or judged or shamed, particularly in their murder? And I disagree 100% with the fact that Jack Lipman should ever have been allowed to have done that and have muddied the water and to create a very different type of case based on incorrect information. So,
well, not just incorrect. I mean, deliberately lying, creating a situation where he could argue things that absolutely did not happen, that absolutely had nothing to do with reality, and just the arrogance. And although Lipman was not present for this, apparently he passed away. His partner was there, and he was almost just as arrogant. There was one point on which he kind of said that Lipman went too far, but we'll get to that eventually.
met Jennifer through Jessica because it was like her people are my people and vice versa. So I met Jennifer and immediately I thought she was cool. Everything that was different about Jennifer was what attracted me to her. The fact that she was Jewish and not a WASP from the Upper East Side, that she lived in Soho. We lived uptown, mm-hmm. and we were already ingrained and enmeshed in this world.
Let's talk about Jennifer Levin. Jennifer was an 18-year-old girl on her way to college. And the one of the most wonderful parts of this whole series is when you get to know Jennifer through her mother, through her sister, and through her friends. I remember living through this. In fact, I was actually engaged in a trial at exactly the same time that they were picking the jury and doing the trial against Chambers in this case. And so I was actually in the courthouse and in the federal courthouse right across the street from where this was going on. And I know Linda Fairstein, and I used to bring her cases. She was the first sex crimes prosecutor in Manhattan, in the Manhattan DA's office. But before that, I was the sex crimes prosecutor in the Bronx before anybody made any kind of, you know, title for that position, because the first sex crimes case that I was on the complaint desk for, as soon as I was in the middle of filling out all the paperwork, my boss said, "Wait, you can't do this." And I was like, "Why? The case came in." "Yeah, but it's a sex crimes case. That has to be one of the female prosecutors."
And I was, weird.
It was weird. But then, that case was taken away from me. But then months later, another case came in that didn't present that way. But I found out that it was a father sexually victimizing three of his sons. And we ended up flipping the case, releasing the defendant that had been brought to me and prosecuting the father. And I had done all that when these witnesses had gone through this. There was an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old boy who had gone through multiple interviews and they had not disclosed to them. But when I talked to them, they did disclose. We figured out the whole thing and we were able to wrap the case up. And after that point, my boss made me the lead prosecutor on child sex crimes cases. So it was a real journey for me. And Linda Fairstein was definitely a champion when it came to prosecuting child sex crimes cases and adult sex crimes cases. So this happened to be, Jennifer Levin happened to be the first murder case that she tried. And it was only the second murder case that was tried by a female prosecutor in the Manhattan County DA's office. So it was groundbreaking.
I mean, and that's amazing, just the historical journey. But I'd like to just dip back into Jennifer, her mm-hmm. victimology, because sure. There's so many misconceptions, I think, about what was put in the media regarding her and what her friends and her family had to say. And it was literally like night and day. You couldn't mm-hmm. get a different profile that was more significant when listening to Peter Davis, one of her best friends, saying that, you know, she was so fun loving. She was from Long Island. She was really sociable, but she was a nerd. She wasn't this kind of wild party girl that people made her out to be, or the media in particular, that she was a very reliable and loyal friend. She was the friend that would always have your back. And she didn't do drugs. She liked to go out, but she didn't drink a lot. And literally everything that was put in the media, this whole sex diary and everything else, was just complete and utter rubbish. And the other thing I wanted to make mention of was the fact that she was 5'1". You know, 5'1", 5'2". Just think about that when we understand that Robert Chambers was 6'4" and 190 pounds. So when you think about the physiology, and Jim, we always think about this, don't we? What do two people look like together? What kind of force would be required? She was tiny in comparison to him, just on a physical level.
I know. It's unbelievable that didn't become a huge component of this trial. I mean, if I were Fairstein, I would have been arguing that the defendant's defense, his statements, they just defy any kind of logic and reason. It's absolutely clear that he was lying. And I would have just hammered that home. And there's so many ways, and we'll get into the details later. But you're right, Laura. I loved how her mother described her as she had so much life, she was born with a smile.
They painted such a full, you know, portrait of her that I'd never right. known and before.
I didn't know this. I was in the middle of a very intense investigation for 19 months and then a 3.5 month trial at the time. So I didn't actually get to drill down into details on this case. So it was so great to actually be able to learn about Jennifer, what kind of person she was, her family. Her mother was so sweet and her sister, and they were so obviously destroyed by this horrific crime.
And I think she was having a lot of fun with this new group of friends. So she had been living on Long Island with her mother and then her parents, and then they divorced, and her father moved to Soho. And what a great adventure to go live in the city. I mean, right. when you grow up on Long Island, the city is this icon, this beacon. Right. And so to be able to go and live with her father in Soho, and then she meets these Upper East Side kids who are way above her status financially. I mean, I'm sure that the Levins were comfortable, but they weren't anywhere near the kind of wealth that these friends that she was making had. And I'm sure that was really fun to be able to.
Right. You know. Or the apparent wealth, right? In one particular case.
Right.
But also what's interesting, and one of the things that I was surprised to learn, was that Jennifer basically considered herself dating Chambers.
Yeah, that was the surprise for me.
I know.
Me too.
And to me, that made all the difference in the world, because that meant that he was leading her on. And I believe that meant that he led her from Dorian's into the park that night. There's no world in which she got him to do something he didn't want to do. He was a commanding presence. He was a very strong personality. And he definitely proved it with Alex, the 16-year-old girl that he was dating, that he is not bound by any sort of social norms. In other words, he will do what he wants to do, and he will throw it right in your face. He made an appointment to meet her at 8 o'clock at Dorian's, and he blew her off, didn't show up till 10:30 or so at night, and looked at her and walked right by her. She'd been waiting, and he knew she had been waiting for hours for him, because he knew that the night before, he had stolen $55 from her and then claimed that he didn't take anything. So that is something that shows to me that he's not going to be, quote, pushed around by social mores, that he can't be manipulated by a girl who wants him to do something. And I think this is a fundamental part of the trial that should have been center, because if he is capable of doing that, then to believe that he only went to the park with Jennifer because Jennifer wanted him to, and he wasn't really into her like that. Well, he'd already had sex with her several times.
Which he'd failed to disclose at any point.
At any point. And the interesting dynamic between Jennifer and Alex that night is, at some point, Jennifer must have learned that from Robert, that Alex was there to see Robert. And what does Jennifer do? She reaches out and gives her a friendship bracelet. She reaches out and tries to make friends with her. That, to me, tells you a lot about what kind of a person Jennifer is. In other words, she didn't look at her with jealousy. She didn't look at her with contempt. She looked at her with love and friendship. And that behavior tells me so much volumes about what kind of person Jennifer Levin was.
I mean, the irony that he's dating multiple people, the very thing that she's accused of. So you have this double standard right from the start. And it would not surprise me if he was actually seeing other girls, women that we don't know about. And if we think that he was 19 at the time and Alex was 16, there's an age difference there too. Now, he just strikes me, and we'll talk about his interview, because I don't know if that's the first time you had seen that footage, Jim. It was certainly the first time I had seen it, and it was very illuminating, just certain word choices and how he conducted himself, and even things like what he called Jennifer, calling her the body. There was some leakage
Absolutely.
In that interview.
I wrote that down too. I touched the body and it didn't move. Oh my God. You're right. I didn't see the detail in all those statements. I had seen pieces of it before. But let's just talk about that. I mean, as you brought it up, Laura, he says that Jennifer came up and wrapped her panties around his wrists and he holds them out in front of him. And then he says, oh, behind my back. And then she pushed me down. And then he says that she started sexually assaulting him and she was raping him, right? Facing away from him, sitting on him. And then this is the flaw. And I can't believe that they didn't bring this out in the trial. He says, I was able to get this hand loose. And I just kind of wrapped it around her arm. And as hard as I could, I flipped her. And she flipped over me and landed by the tree. But he just said his hands were tied together. So if one hand was loose, both hands were loose. But he kept his right hand behind his back. Why did he do that? Because he wanted to make it look like he was in an inferior position and he had to fight for himself. When it's a lie, if he got one hand loose, the other hand was just as equally loose. Because they were just tied together with a pair of flimsy little panties.
Right. And her panties were found far away from her body.
Exactly.
So,
far away. So it didn't match. And I don't know whether they actually drove that home to the jury, the absurdity of it. And I think they should have tried to push away all that other bullshit and just focus on the fact that if you listen to his statement, it is so internally flawed, so inconsistent with the facts, that it's obviously absurd. And to believe any of it is to believe a complete lie.
What did you think of his affect in that video, Jim and Laura? His attitude, just the way that he just carried himself in an interview.
Right.
Well, let's remember his impression management, first of all, because he's doing his hair and he's thinking about his cosmetic impression appearance, that he's going to make and his appearance. So we can see that he is vain. We can see he's conscious of his looks. And he's confident.
Mm-hmm.
That really struck me. At his age, being that confident with detectives, one, volunteering to go down to the police station and sitting there so confident in what he's saying. But I got the impression he was just making it up as he went along. There wasn't a beginning, middle and end for him. He was having to think what may have happened, what might they buy has happened. For me, I could see the cogs turning, but some of the most significant parts are him talking about the fact that he just sat there watching and he didn't call for help. If it were an accident, for example, if you didn't have someone like you, Jim, taking apart what he said, the fact that he claims that his own admission was that he just sat there. He didn't do CPR. He didn't help her. And then he just walked home afterwards. And at no point did he make himself known. And he just goes to sleep.
Right. I think there's so many things there, Laura. So the first thing is her earrings and her money are missing, right? And there, the prosecution is precluded from bringing up all the robberies that he committed because the judge doesn't see a connection, a nexus to the case, because they can't prove that he actually stole things from her. But the fact is, his admission that he went over, sat on a bench and looked at her, just stared at her. He watched her. He didn't say somebody came and robbed her of those things.
Right.
So his own statement proves that he's the only one who could have taken it. And yet the judge still excluded it. So there's that part of it. But let's get back to his demeanor in the interview. To me, what was really striking, if you look at his demeanor in that interview and juxtapose it with Lippman, when he's making the statement in Chambers' defense, he says it was just the activity that was going on and he was trying to dissuade her from doing this to him and it was just a tragic accident. And then he goes like this. He does this big gulp. It's a fight or flight response. It's a stress response. He is less comfortable saying Chambers lies than Chambers is. Chambers is a 19-year-old at this point? A 19-year-old in front of two big detectives who are seasoned, who know exactly what they're doing, who investigate homicides every day. And he's sitting there and he's basically holding court. How many times did he flip his hair back? How many times did he adjust it? How many times did he adjust himself in the seat and lean in and actually convince them with the way he presented himself? And then the calm in which he was able to answer questions when they asked him for more details and they asked him how it was done. When you see somebody who has that calm, cool, collected ability, immediately tells me, I want to measure him up against the PCLR, the psychopathy checklist, because he's charming. Everybody describes him as charming and all this other stuff. Pathological liar, multiple different kinds of crimes. I mean, he's just ticking off most of the factors on the psychopathy checklist, including juvenile delinquency, including this grandiose self-worth, no remorse, no taking no responsibility, acting impulsively, all these things, the drug addiction. I mean, all of this just tells me he's a classic psychopath.
To watch his face and his entire ensemble crumble is a feeling that every homicide detective feels, that you know you have the guy in the ropes. He punched himself in the leg and welled up with tears and the sniffles and said, what's my mother gonna say?
Well, there was certainly a power and control dynamic in there, and there was just a couple of moments where you saw it. And when he started to tell his story about what happened, his narrative, and I'm calling it a false forensic narrative, He says to one of the detectives, pay attention, detective.
Right.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and it's very jarring when you hear someone who is in that kind of flow right. and trying to be much bigger and greater than, and now I've right. got you listening to me. And there was another unconscious utterance, which I thought was instructive, which was, what will mother say?
Right.
And right. so I am very curious about his relationship with his mother and what was going on between her and him, and the fact that she obviously kicked him out the house. She must have known quite a lot of what was going on, but how much of a disciplinarian was she and an authority figure? It's a shame not to hear her account of him growing up, because she clearly had high aspirations for him too. And I wonder what pressure that brought to bear. And it's not excusing him in any way, shape or form. But I just wonder how controlling she may have been. And Robert Friedman did say, oh, I think she was a victim too. And she may well have been, but it's very hard to get a read. But particularly when he does admit that he killed her, but the thing that is in his head is, what will my mother say?
Right.
I just felt that whole narrative, his false forensic narrative, and of course, Jennifer's not here to say otherwise, but she tied my hands. She was having her way. It was all so vague. No real detail was there that it gave me no sense of plausibility, veracity, that it actually happened at all, even though he did try and demonstrate. And I felt that his demonstration was much more about trying to confuse more than anything and distract, because he was just making it up as he went along. And he then started to say that he didn't want to see the pictures as soon as one of the detectives got irritated with him and just wasn't buying it. He's trying to show him the pictures of what happened to Jennifer. And I thought it was interesting. I'd rather not see the pictures. I'd rather not see them, as if this is a choice. And then he talks about men being raped, which I'm sure we'll come back to when we talk about the Catholic Church in particular. But he uses words like, she was pushy. How plausible is that with his physicality versus her physicality? It is ridiculous. And that's what the detective was getting irritated about. But I thought the end was very strange, where he had admitted to killing her and then he just got up. Can I go now? Yeah. I thought that was a very bizarre ending.
Well, because he thought he had convinced them that it was her fault. And his whole thing, everything from the time they decided to go outside, her idea to go outside, he wasn't interested in her. She wanted to go to the park. She wanted to sit by the tree. She went crazy and scratched his face. She said how cute he looked, and he'd look cuter tied up. Wait a second. That's after she scratched your face? She said you look cute? I'm going to tie you up? I mean, it makes no sense, but here he is paying himself a compliment through this dead girl's eyes, right? I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Well, that's forgetting about all the scratches, Jim, of course. Yes, yeah. Because he had a face full of scratches on a body, and she had defense wounds all over her, too.
All over her. And then he said, she was raping me, dug her nails into my chest. I was in pain, and I just grabbed at her as hard as I could and across her neck, and she landed there by the tree and didn't move. And I touched the body, and it didn't move. And that was chilling. Just that one word, body. And the prosecutor asked him, well, did you know she was dead? You said the body. And he goes, no, I didn't know. I didn't know at all. I just touched her. I just looked at her. I just didn't. I was scared. It's that grandiose self-worth that's coming out here. I've said this. Now, believe me. Now you are commanded to believe me. Pay attention, detective. It was just like, oh, my God, the arrogance of that statement.
So the DA was called up and comes down, and he and Detective Sheehan are asking questions to Chambers in this videotape. And then later he's conflicted out of the case because he was the one doing the questioning. But we know that in the case of the Central Park Exonerated Five, Fairstein was also the one doing the questioning, but she wasn't conflicted out of the case. So
that was a very convenient excuse, Lisa, because every time a prosecutor interviews a witness, there has to be a law enforcement officer there so that they don't become the sole witness to the utterance. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in this case, if Mike Sheehan was there for the whole thing, then there's no reason to conflict out the DA. He's not conflicted out because he has a law enforcement witness who can testify to the conversation. And that's all you need. So I think it was a very political thing, and it might have been an image thing that they
wanted a woman. That was my read. They wanted a woman on it, and they wanted to give Linda a shot. You know, I think sometimes it's just optics, isn't it? And for whatever reason, Linda was the chosen one.
Right. And if Sheehan was there for the whole time, you couldn't tell from the camera angle whether Sheehan was there or not. But there were times when he spoke. I don't know if he left the room. If he left the room at all and the conversation continued, that might be why, but I don't know, either here or there, but he obviously was very upset that he got taken off the case. It was his
right. Problem.
And it doesn't happen like that very often.
I thought he was quite diplomatic about it in what he said, but right. You could still sense the anger 30 plus years on, because he obviously felt very invested. It's a big case to put someone on who hasn't prosecuted a homicide before. And I think that it was a very interesting dynamic that it created with Jack Lippman. That told me a lot, the fact that he wrote in the book to Linda Fairstein saying, I'm going to enjoy doing battle with you, the flirtation.
Right.
It made my skin crawl, actually. The whole way he conducted himself, some people might say that Jack Lippman was brilliant, and people say don't speak ill of the dead. But I got to say, I think it's probably pretty hot down where he is right now. Because that to me is not brilliance, it's pure manipulation. And I felt, even just hearing what he'd written to Linda, that he was going to try and manipulate her too.
Yeah.
So, and obviously it made the documentary, you did get the sense there was no love lost between them. And, you know, in fact, there was a lot of tension between them and probably a lot of pressure on Linda. She's obviously received a lot of very negative criticism, and you know, I was critical of her too, but I got the sense with this case it was a different kettle of fish, and she was really trying to do her best.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You can't help but want to champion her. You want to champion a woman who's going to go to bat to give voice to this victim. But what we know about Fairstein later is definitely makes it conflicting when you think about her.
Yeah.
But I think talking about crime scene, and we go back to the 1980s, and I think it's a very valid point, Jim, what you said about the hands being tied behind the back, which means if one is free, they both are. They're clearly not thinking in that way at that time.
It's mind-boggling, because as he's doing the demonstration, he made a point of making sure he kept his right hand behind his back. When he didn't say she tied each hand separately to my belt loop or something like that. He said he did like this, and she wrapped it around. Well, panties don't go around like 15 right. times.
How
right?
big are these yes. knickers? I mean, it's just
ridiculous.
Not possible.
It's
particularly
not possible.
With a guy as big as him. But also when we think about the Central Park case, we know from Trisha's crime scene, there weren't multiple offenders. And that was something Linda got horribly wrong,
right,
as did, you know, everybody in that case. And right, we forensically deconstructed that case the same way as this one. So what it tells us and where we land is that their knowledge and understanding of crime scene and crime scene assessment and victimology wasn't where we are now, present day. And again, that's no one's fault. It's as our knowledge moves on.
Right.
And particularly as a new, you know, prosecutor prosecuting homicide, I would imagine as a female, there was a lot of pressure on her at that time.
Right. Well, we have so much more to discuss. And when we come back next week, we're going to continue talking about the case of the murder of Jennifer Levin in the documentary series, The Preppy Murder.
For now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the exonerated five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.